Welcome. Today is Tuesday, February 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, dueling rallies in a Texas border town between President Trump and a popular Democrat over border wall funding.
Today, we started a big, beautiful wall right on the Rio Grande.
U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic forces are closing in on Islamic State's last stronghold in eastern Syria. And the acting U.S. defense chief makes an unannounced trip to Afghanistan. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, with another government shutdown threat looming, President Donald Trump is in El Paso, Texas, near the Mexico border. Trump holding a campaign-style rally as he once again makes his case for border walls and says they work as Democrats spurn his demands for billions to build that barrier.
But if we had proper border security, including a very powerful wall, we wouldn't have to work so hard. And it would be a lot safer and a lot better. My administration is committed to ending illegal immigration while modernizing our legal immigration system, which has been in terrible shape for many, many decades.
Trump's in Texas, aiming to reshape the debate around the wall following a damaging shutdown fight, and with his signature 2016 campaign promise hanging in limbo. And in a case of pointed political counter-programming, Beto O'Rourke, the former Democratic congressman from Texas, now mulling a presidential run, held a dueling El Paso march and rally against the wall, with dozens of local groups attending.
In one of the safest cities in the United States of America. Safe. Not because of walls, but in spite of walls. Secure, because we treat one another with dignity and respect. That is the way that we make our communities and our country safe.
Well, joining us live now to talk more about these competing events, particularly the president's speeches, VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Lori.
Well, is it safe to say this is likely the first of many dueling rallies in the 2020 election season over the direction of this country?
Most likely. It's the first time we've seen this, and President Trump is still on the stage in El Paso, so this is turning into quite the marathon, and of course he's disputing the size of the competing rally, saying his was much bigger, underestimating the size of the crowd that Beto O'Rourke attracted. In fact, so close to where President Trump's holding his rally that at the O'Rourke event, you could actually hear the music before Trump got on stage coming about several hundred meters away.
Wow.
From where Trump was holding his event.
That's incredible. Well, there was a lot of controversy over the president's claims about El Paso and safety issues. Did he talk about that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He went after the Republican mayor of El Paso, Dean Margo, who ahead of the president's visit had said the wall was not the sole deterrent for reducing illegal immigration and curbing criminals. The president said that any mayor, whether they're Republican or Democrat, who does not believe a wall makes a difference is, quote, full of crap.
All right. Well, it does look like there may be a tentative agreement about at least keeping the government from shutting down again at this midnight Friday deadline. Democrats and Republicans in Washington seem to have reached some sort of potential agreement.
Well, they're hedging it, saying that nothing is certain, that they have an outline. And in that outline, according to congressional aides, is $1.375 billion. For about 88 kilometers of border fence. Now, that's a number much smaller than the president has wanted. And perhaps somewhat ominously, as Trump was speaking on the Fox News channel, one of the president's strong supporters, Sean Hannity, actually broke into the conservative network's coverage of the rally to mention that smaller amount and warned Republican lawmakers against supporting what Sean Hannity called, quote, this garbage compromise.
Wow. What about the competing event with Beto O'Rourke? Was he focused heavily on immigration issues and describing Trump's fear-mongering at all about the wall?
Yes, absolutely, Lori. It was speaking a lot about the inclusiveness and the benefits of having migrants coming into the United States and warning about walls. O'Rourke said at one point, walls do not save lives, walls end lives. And he said that in the last 10 years, more than 4,000 children, women, and men have died trying to come to this country. And he noted that the president describes immigrants as rapists and criminals. Of course, countering that perception and pointing to El Paso and saying that the city's diversity has really made it a wonderful place.
And did both sides seem to attract the same size crowd, or was there a distinction between Trump versus O'Rourke's rally? Could you tell?
Well, yes. The president has a much larger venue. Now, we know that the president has a history of exaggerating numbers. He claimed that 69,000 people had signed up to attend and that the fire marshals had let 10,000 in, and there were many thousands outside watching on large monitors. He mocked the O'Rourke rally, saying that he has 200 people, 300 people, not too good, saying that may be the end of O'Rourke's presidential bid. Now, some preliminary numbers that we've heard from law enforcement officials there are estimating that this counter rally by the Democrat perhaps attracted about 7,000 people.
Hmm. All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective and your time. That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Lauren.
Well, the recent shutdown, of course, left more than 800,000 government workers without paychecks, forced the postponement of the president's State of the Union, and sent Trump's poll numbers tumbling. So he ultimately surrendered after the shutdown hit 35 days, agreeing to the current temporary reopening without getting money for the wall. We shall see what happens with this tentative agreement. The president's supporters have suggested that Trump could use executive powers to divert money from the federal budget for wall construction, though he could face some challenges in Congress or the courts over it. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A Muslim U.S. lawmaker apologizes for comments deemed anti-Semitic. As Brexit deadline looms, Britain's Theresa May twists and turns. A European court deals a blow to human rights efforts in Turkey. And a smartwatch that can tell if you're sick but not tell time. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The acting U.S. Secretary of Defense made an unannounced visit Monday to Afghanistan, where he says he has not received orders to withdraw American troops. The visit comes as the U.S. continues peace negotiations with the Taliban to end nearly two decades of war there. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan told reporters before his unannounced stop in Kabul, the United States is not discussing any size troop withdrawal.
I have not been directed to step down our forces in Afghanistan. The direction, and this is in close coordination with Secretary Pompeo and Ambassador Bolton, is to support Ambassador Khalilzad and these peace negotiations.
Last week, during the State of the Union address, President Donald Trump slammed U.S. involvement in prolonged conflicts.
Great nations do not fight endless wars.
He also praised peace talks with the Taliban, seeing them as a way to bring American troops home from Afghanistan.
As we make progress in these negotiations, we will be able to reduce our troops' presence and focus on counterterrorism, and we will indeed focus on counterterrorism. We do not know whether we'll achieve an agreement, but we do know that after two decades of war, the hour has come to at least try for peace.
Shanahan said Monday the United States would determine the size of its troop presence in Afghanistan in a coordinated and disciplined manner. He added that the presence would continue to defend the American homeland while supporting regional stability.
The U.S. has significant investment in ensuring security. But the Afghans decide their future.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's government has not participated in ongoing talks between U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad and the Taliban. Khalilzad and his team are due to meet with the Taliban again February 25th in Qatar. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Well, South Korea and the United States have struck a new deal as of Sunday that increases Seoul's contribution to the cost of the American military presence on its soil, overcoming previous failed negotiations that caused worries about the decades-long alliance. The development comes as President Trump is set to hold his second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Vietnam later this month. South Korea last year provided about $830 million to cover roughly 40% of the cost of the deployment of more than 28,000 U.S. troops, whose presence is meant to deter aggression from North Korea. On Sunday, chief negotiators from the two countries signed a new cost-sharing plan. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked to Bruce Bennett, a senior international defense researcher at the RAND Corporation, who's currently at U.S. Camp Humphrey in South Korea, where he describes the significance of the agreement.
Well, I think it was very important to conclude it as rapidly as possible. The growing debate over the so-called burden-sharing amount was causing a fair amount of concern in Korea about whether the United States would pull troops out or do other things that would not be good for the alliance. So the fact that this has gotten resolved relatively quickly after the commitment for the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, I think that's very healthy, and unfortunately, we're going to be back to the bargaining table very soon.
Now, does that open a deal, one might say, between Trump and Kim when they meet in Hanoi?
Well, I certainly hope not. One of Kim's objectives forever has been to get U.S. troops off the peninsula and thereby to either significantly undermine or, at an extreme, to destroy the U.S.-South Korean alliance. He wants that because that's how he sees getting to his future. And so we don't want to have that kind of friction develop where a U.S. troop withdrawal and a break of the alliance could develop. It could be very, very bad for regional security.
But in your estimation, does the deal-making mind of the President of the United States still possibly have that in the back of his mind?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, we don't know what exactly President Trump is thinking. The thing, though, that needs to be emphasized here is while the South Korean National Assembly's got to approve this deal, they aren't going to increase the defense budget to pay the extra amount of money. The bottom line is that's going to have to come out of something in a fixed defense budget. And currently, when South Korea's had to make an agreement in the defense budget, what they've done is take it out of equipment acquisition. That means American businesses will most likely suffer the loss of this money transfer to go directly to the U.S. government. This will likely cost U.S. jobs.
Can you ascertain what the feeling of the Korean public is about this?
I've just been in Korea just under one day. So my sense, though, from media depictions and from other things, people are glad this debate is over. They wanted it to not be a big issue. They wanted to make sure that this was not going to hurt the alliance. And so I think people are going to be very happy, but worried still about the future.
Do you expect this to have any effect whatsoever on the upcoming summit meeting?
Well, I think Kim Jong-un's going to be disappointed. He was very hopeful that this split in perspectives was going to really injure the alliance. So I think he's going to be disappointed that the U.S. and South Korea were able to compromise and put the importance of the alliance ahead of this monetary issue. I think he's still going to likely press President Trump to withdraw some number of American troops in exchange for something on his side. The problem we face, though, now is Kim keeps asking for compensating measures, for corresponding measures. Right now, Kim is building more nuclear weapons and more ballistic missiles. Corresponding measures would be enhanced sanctions and added information operations against North Korea. We're not at a stage to relax sanctions yet, not until North Korea stops its Cold War against the United States and behaves more responsibly. So President Trump's got a big job ahead of him at the end of February.
Do you think that the meeting is advisable?
Oh, I think it's advisable. I mean, the president, when you deal with people in Asia, there are two dimensions of any negotiation. The first is the personal dimension. And President Trump had good results on the personal dimension with the first summit and since then, but he's got to re-energize that. So that's important. The second dimension is the substance. And that's where we're not sure whether Kim is prepared to give anything. If he's not, then there may not be a whole lot of reason for further negotiation and further interaction. The U.S. may just need to turn up the pressure. So this is a difficult time in terms of trying to see both what Kim Jong-un is going to do and what President Trump is going to do.
That is Bruce Bennett with the RAND Corporation. U.S.-backed coalition forces in Syria have launched an offensive to remove Islamic State militants from their last stronghold close to the border with Iraq, but their advance is halted by the exodus of civilians from the area. Fighters also say the militants are putting up fierce resistance to their advance. VOA's Larika Hoke reports.
Thousands of civilians have fled the militant-held enclave in eastern Syria ahead of the coalition offensive that began last week. Among them are members of Islamic State families, including this young widow.
I came here without knowledge, and knowledge is very important in Islam. And I didn't regret because this makes me experience to be strong and to be mother and to be very strong.
Observers say more than 20,000 people so far have fled the area comprised of two villages on the border with Iraq and smaller groups who are still trickling out from the village of Bahuz on Sunday.
There is a great displacement and look how people are leaving. And we slow down shooting so that we do not hurt civilians.
The arrivals undergo an initial security check outside Bahuz to separate civilians from Islamic State members. Civilians are then moved to a displacement camp outside the fighting zone. A man from Ireland has been detained as suspected jihadist.
We thought the more kids we will have, maybe we'll have the more women and kids. If you go as a big group, this will be less dangerous. Maybe they're not, because they would see so many people, and especially with the kids crying, maybe they would not harm us.
Many people fleeing the area are foreigners.
There are all kinds of people here. There are many Arabs, foreigners in great numbers. Houses do not accommodate them. They're in the streets, the tents, and trenches.
Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces say militants are increasingly using civilians as human shields to block their advance. Islamic State fighters are putting up fierce resistance in the village of Bahuz, the final holdout in eastern Syria.
Currently, we are at the edge of Bahuz. Hopefully, during this period, we'll be able to liberate it from the Islamic State group. We have high hopes and high morale. We won't return home until we have liberated it completely from the forces of terrorism.
Islamic State once controlled large swaths of Iraq and Syria, but its self-proclaimed caliphate has been dismantled through a concerted international effort in the past few years. The extremist group still holds small pockets of land in both countries and is capable of inflicting heavy casualties on the attacking forces. Zlarica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Many of the Venezuelans who cross the Simon Bolivar Bridge each day between the city of Cúcuta in Colombia and the state of Táchira in Venezuela ask, what's next? VOA's Cristina Sacedo-Smith reports from the Venezuela-Colombia border that more than 50 tons of humanitarian aid has been delivered with no clear path on how to get the food and medicine into Venezuela.
After the arrival of the first load of aid from the U.S. and Colombian governments to the international Tienditas Bridge in Cúcuta, Venezuela's self-proclaimed interim president Juan Guaidó sent a direct message to the Venezuelan armed forces during a VOA interview.
They know what is happening in Venezuela. They have friends who had left the country. They suffer what we all suffer. This is an order for the military. Allow humanitarian aid to enter. It will be a turning point for you. Not saving lives implies a crime against humanity.
U.S. Ambassador to Colombia Kevin Whitaker welcomed the food supplies, emphasizing the United States had helped Venezuelans with more than $140 million. He says more help is expected.
This is a down payment. This is just a beginning. It's important. It's significant. It will be distributed to Venezuelans in Venezuela.
Ambassador Whitaker also thanked Colombian President Iván Duque for the transportation of this first load of help into the Venezuelan border.
En la parte de Colombia,
on the Colombian side, our mission is to transport, store, and supervise, have all the pertinent security up to the border.
At the International Simón Bolívar Bridge, thousands of Colombians and Venezuelans walk between countries every day. After the first shipment of aid, which consists in items like rice, coffee, powder milk, canola oil, among other items, more Venezuelans are arriving to ask if the aid is going to be delivered in Colombia. In the meantime, while the food and medicine are safely stored in a warehouse at the Tienditas Bridge, 65-year-old Venezuelan Carmen Sanchez is hoping the food can be delivered in Venezuela.
The only thing I ask God is that Maduro leaves and that there is no battle with other countries, much less people dead.
For other Venezuelans that cross the bridge every day, the only way of buying things like onions, rice, and eggs is in Colombia. They claim there is no work and no money to buy things that are overpriced in Venezuela.
The aid has to get to Venezuela. In Venezuela, people are dying. That is the reality.
Venezuela's president in dispute, Nicolas Maduro, rejected the U.S. humanitarian aid and will not allow it into the country, assuring Venezuelans do not need it. Meanwhile, Guaido is expected to announce two other gathering centers in Latin America and is also considering implementing a humanitarian corridor to bring the aid into Venezuela. Cristina Quecedo Smith, VOA News, Cúcuta, Colombia.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. From Los Angeles to London to Cape Town, South Africa, veganism and vegan products are gaining popularity. The Economist and Forbes have dubbed 2019 as the year of the vegan. VOA's Mariama Diallo tells us more about this entirely plant-based diet.
Tocaya Organica, a Mexican restaurant chain with outlets in California and Arizona, says it's set to open 11 more restaurants in the U.S. and abroad by the end of 2019. CEO and co-founder Tosh Berman says the vegan message is simple.
The message of Tocaya is really, it's a message of better living. Better living from a health perspective, better living on the impact that it creates on the environment, the ingredients that we put in our body.
Have a nice day. Thank you.
Eric Gallen, a personal talent manager, and Julia Rose, a social media creator, are regular customers. Gallen says a good dose of vegan food is a must for him.
Today, for example, I started at 7 a.m. I'll have 8 meetings today. And if I don't eat well, I don't feel good, I don't have energy, I don't perform well.
Grocery stores like this one in the Los Angeles area are also trying to cater to this trend. Airborne organic grocer and cafe brand manager Joyce DeBrevain says veganism is growing.
Whether people are deciding to go vegan for ethical reasons
for health reasons or because of climate change concerns. We definitely are seeing more and more people, probably not going all the way vegan, but definitely incorporating more vegan items into their diet.
The vegan philosophy extends to clothing and cosmetics too. Many beauty products include honey, beeswax, and keratin, which is a protein found in animal cells. In London's Hackney neighborhood, James Fisher opened Whip, a vegan hair salon.
We wanted to be as eco-friendly, sustainable, and cruelty-free as possible. And being a vegan hair salon is part of that. So our products are vegan and organic, and the refreshments that we serve are vegan as well.
Sarah Maddox is a client at the salon.
I choose to have my hair done at Whip because I really appreciate their company ethos. I try to align the way I spend my money with my personal values, and this is something that's quite important to me.
A report by US-based Grandview Research said the global vegan cosmetic market is estimated at $12.9 billion. And according to a report by research firm Global Data, 6% of US customers claimed to be vegan in 2017, up from just 1% in 2014. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Well, the Hollywood film industry is hard for anyone to break into. There may be a few more hurdles, even so, if you are a woman and Muslim. But as VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles, one such filmmaker is finding success in Hollywood and in her own community.
One look at movie director and writer Lena Khan, and it's obvious she doesn't fit the Hollywood director stereotype.
It's very hard to be a female filmmaker in Hollywood, that is for sure. I think they feel like you don't have as much authority, or you can't command a set as much, or does seem like they won't give you a chance or a risk quite as much. And for the Muslim thing, I just think they are still trying to process that.
Khan is a child of immigrants from India. In school, she explored several career options before deciding on filmmaking, a choice that sparked some criticism in her South Asian community.
When I was starting out, like, people in the community, South Asian as well, most of all, they were like, why are you entering such a stupid career?
She persisted, fighting to get funding for a film called Tiger Hunter.
How many people actually live here?
11, maybe 13.
Released in 2017, it's a comedy about the immigrant experience of a man from India in the U.S. Khan says the success of this movie surprised people in her community.
People who are South Asian or Muslim can't seem to believe that our stories have any really real value. And so the moment you start talking about, oh, you know, such and such person from this company, aka white person, said this movie is good, that's when their eyebrows raise. And that's when they feel like, oh, okay, somebody else validated this brown person's story, and thus it has something to say.
Khan says the film's universal themes and the coincidental timing of its release helped make it a success.
And the Muslim ban happened right when the movie came out, you know, and that was never intended, it's not a good thing, but it became very, very relevant.
Tiger Hunter launched Khan's career. Khan says she will continue to navigate through Hollywood on her own terms and pursue her passion in writing and directing.
I like what I'm doing. I mean, I like it. I feel like it has some value. It's incredibly fun. And then I'm also a faithful person where it's always, for me, it's about sort of like how you went about your day and kind of what you tried, and the results are up to God.
Khan is now working on a TV comedy and directing a movie for Disney. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And on this day in music history?
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man.
58 years ago today, on February 12th, 1961, this song, Shop Around by the Miracles, became Motown Records' first million-selling single. The group didn't stop there. In the 10 years that followed, they had 6 more million-dollar hits.
Shop around.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a beautiful day.
This is VOA News.